Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Flat Nickel Podcast. I am your host, Hannah Nawa, joined by my always producer and occasional co-host, Mr. Sam Fritz.
Good morning, everyone.
It is morning. I'm trying hard not to drink my coffee while recording these introductions. But today's interview, we are very excited to introduce, was Megan and Bern Cly from Megan Jean and the KFB, which is an amazing duo. You definitely have to go and check out their music. They are extremely talented people. We sat down with Megan and Bern in the green room of the Thought Lot. They stopped by on their way to a gig in Frederick, I believe. We sat down with them for about an hour to just discuss the music industry and their careers and their lives. They had a lot of really great stories and a lot of really great insight to what it's like to be sort of in Americana in the music industry. And also they talked about their new upcoming album that they are releasing later this summer. Just a really great, interesting interview that I think you guys are really going to enjoy.
I think where we get the biggest amount of the best part of this interview is that they're very impassioned speakers, both of them, you know, super heavily opinionated, which listeners love. People who listen to this podcast are absolutely going to love just the intensity with which they speak about topics in the music industry. And it's one of those things of whether or not you agree or not, it's still interesting to hear the viewpoints of others. And it really was, it was cool on my end to be interviewing artists who they even admitted to not necessarily trying to be independent. They had a run at being with a label, and that path didn't treat them right. So now they're learning the benefits of being independent artists. And it's kind of cool getting to see that perspective, because for the most part, I think artists who we've interviewed have, for the most part, chosen to be independent.
Mm-hmm. They've started independent, and mm-hmm. they've stayed unsigned.
And these guys, you know, I don't think they have anything. They even admit in the interview that they enjoy being independent now, but they did try to go the traditional music route and it didn't necessarily treat them right. So it's going to be really nice to get to see how that viewpoint has molded and shaped their music career.
And with that being said, let's start our interview with Megan and Bern Cly of Megan Jean and the KFB.
All right. So the first thing I was asked, I talked to my dad last night. We drove down from New Hampshire last night. Got home at midnight. Mm-hmm. Stopped in Connecticut for an interview and then went home. We got home at like 12:30. Mm-hmm. So the car ride home was after you guys said that you were going to do this. We just, as a family, discussed topics. We're like, what should we ask them? Which was a great family bonding experience.
Yes.
Was my parents helping me decide my interview questions. But I don't know this story. How did you guys meet, and what sort of inspired you guys to start collaborating?
Yeah, we met at an amateur experimental dance show called Moist Tiny Elephants in the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute on 15th and Irving in New York City.
That's right.
And we both went to the cast party. I had two roommates in it, and it was the last day of the run, and I had no more excuses. I had to go. And I wasn't, I mean, it was like amateur experimental dance, so I put it off, and it was awful. Sorry, guys. Bern was there because he was trying to meet chicks.
You ever seen the movie Moonrise Kingdom?
Yeah.
When he meets the girl at the beginning, he goes backstage at the show and just goes, not you, not you, you. That was pretty much exactly how it went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Pretty much. So, and we've been together ever since. And we dated for a year. I didn't let him hear me sing for like 4 months or
something like that.
Four or five months. I want to know that he liked me. And every time I had dated musicians, they were just like, you're going to sing in my band. And I was like, no. Because it always goes bad, right?
Very tasteful response.
Yeah. And then I met him.
And I already had a band.
And he was like too busy with his stuff, and I was doing my solo stuff. And then he finally came out to a show, and he was like, you're going to sing in my band. And I was like, okay. But it was our band. Instead of his band, it was our band.
Well, we didn't really start playing music together until about a year.
Yeah, it was a year later. Yeah.
A year later.
Yeah, I mean, a year after we met.
We were doing different.
Normally couples meet through music, and then they get together, mm-hmm. but we actually met, and then we made a band. So
out of
personal curiosity and for the listeners at home, what is amateur experimental dance?
Right. It is a lot of...
It's tedious.
It's student actors in leotards making, like... it's just, like, a lot of movements. They were... It was an exploration of movement via dance. So there was just, like, a lot of... I mean...
I didn't know what was going on.
It's just an excuse for actors to touch each other.
That's why I went there. I was like, there's... I was, like, living in New York City at the time, and I had no money. And I was all alone. I had no job. And I was like,
He had a roommate or a friend in it, right?
Yeah, we both had a mutual friend, who was in it. He's like, I'm doing this show this weekend. And I was like, that's free. And
that friend since has gone on to Yale Drama, and he was in a Starburst commercial.
There we go. Tomas Andron.
So every time I watch commercials Tomas. Now, and I'll like see someone like in the commercial being like, Domino's, I'll be like, they went to Juilliard. I went to Tisch School of the Arts at NYU, and so I have lots of actor jokes.
Yeah.
I've never even tried to be an actor. When I was as a student, I just went, oh God, no. I'd much rather do music. And I think if you're going to pick an area of the arts, you really do have to stick with what you're the most passionate about. So it was music for me.
Yeah. But then you can branch out from there, but you keep that. I mean, yeah. We just bumped into each other and it worked out. I mean, that's really what happened. We just got real lucky, bumped into each other.
I was not looking.
I wasn't looking for this. Definitely wasn't looking for this, but like it turned out amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, we met each other and we were into the same stuff. And then we were living in New York City and it was impossible for either of us to really thrive there.
It's really hard to pay rent. There's a whole musical about it.
Yeah. You know, we were both working. She was working at the end. She was working at an antique and architectural salvage shop.
Which I loved that job. It was great.
And I worked for an instrument rental company driving a delivery truck in the city and doing whatever. And we were just working
to pay rent.
Yeah, we were both working to pay rent.
Drinking like a jug of like Burgundy wine every week. I just didn't know what to do with myself. And you can't play very often in New York City. And
no one cares about you.
When you do, it's like Monday night at midnight time slots. And you have to bring 50 people or they'll never book you again. That kind of stuff. So it was just kind of like New York City is a networking party for America's trust funded elite. And that wasn't me. So I left. As far as the arts go, it's just rich children. It's just rich children buying their way into the parties that you're supposed to go to.
I mean, and I had
the working class artist that comes up out of New York, or the, you know, the hustler artist, like that's very, very not the case anymore. It's just so very different now.
Yeah.
There'd be no Jackson Pollock today. There'd be no Basquiat. Yeah. They wouldn't have the buy-in to get into the social circles.
It's tough. Anymore. I mean, I moved to New York City when I was 21, somewhere in there. I think 20. And like, I went there to learn. Yeah. I went there to find my teachers, and I found them. And then we were done, and we had to get out.
Yep, I agree.
There was no future.
New York City was a great teacher.
It was a great teacher. It got us. I mean, we met. When I met Megan, I was playing in a punk band. And was actually traveling around the world doing that and touring. And it was all DIY tours. We were booking ourselves. And so then after Megan and I met, we've been playing music for a minute. One night, you know, we were trying to figure out what to do with ourselves. And one night Megan rolled over in bed and said, how about we sell our stuff and just go on the road? And I thought that was a great idea, because otherwise it felt like bailing out a sinking ship with a thimble, trying to survive in that city. And I had known that the Southeast was a really good tour circuit, and we'd had a lot of luck down there. So Megan and I just put our heads together, and we started booking shows. And this was in 2006, 2007. So we were doing it on MySpace, which honestly, going out into the ether and no one knows you from Adam, and you're just trying to make connections to establish shows. It was actually, at that time, MySpace was a much better resource than a lot of the social media we have today, because it was just a completely open platform that was largely unregulated. And we were able to like just meet some people and book some shows in some areas around the Southeast. And then we just got down there and we just kept it going. And that was 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's how we met.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
answered so many questions that I had prepared to ask without me asking.
I was going to give a follow-up of what came next after New York, but yeah.
Yeah, so we spent a year and a half on the road and then kind of landed in Charleston, South Carolina, which was actually at the time, it's insanely crowded now, but at the time it was a sleepy little twilight before it became one of the fastest growing housing markets in America. I actually grew up in the Pacific Northwest, which is now the third most expensive housing market in America, and I can't afford to live there. And then I moved to New York City, which is the second most expensive housing market in the United States, and I couldn't afford to live there anymore. And then we moved to Charleston, South Carolina, which is now in the top 10 of the fastest growing and getting to be most expensive places in America. And now we live in Springville, Pennsylvania, population 800 and something. And if that becomes one of the fastest growing, most expensive places to live in America, give me a hat, put mustard on it, I'll eat it. Because it's rural. It's rural, 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 rural. You know PA, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we at. There's a lot of people up there that are very confused about what side of the Civil War Pennsylvania was in. Tell you what, they don't seem to know.
That's also not inaccurate.
No, it's not.
It's really, to me, it's very shocking. Like, in no way is that...
Where we're at, the major industry is commuting to New Jersey for work.
We can't get a gig there.
I mean,
we
can't get a gig.
There are no gigs. It's great.
Yeah. Not in our immediate area. We found something. Pennsylvania's got a lot
this
of surprises.
This is a local gig. Playing in Shippensburg is a local gig for us.
Yeah. There's a lot of little pockets.
3 hours.
In Pennsylvania, little things.
We need to find the weirdos. We need to find more weirdos. So you hear that? Weirdos in Pennsylvania? Like, I mean, the good weirdos, not actual...
the creepy ones?
Creepy weirdos. I don't like that. That's not my kind of weirdo.
This is what I'll say about the Southeast. And this is one thing that is wonderful about the Southern people. Is they have social relationships are incredibly important.
Keystone State.
And they put a lot of effort into, like,
I'm such a grown up,
cultivating personal relationships. And they're a lot more outgoing than the whole entire rest of
the world.
Word
is gregarious.
Right. So let's imagine, like, if I'm a musician and I'm in New York City or anywhere in the Northeast, hell, you know.
The music tradition in the South goes back so long and is such a huge part of society. When you go to New Jersey and you say, I'm a musician, people go, what for? I've never heard of you. You're not famous. It's a cover band. If it's not a cover band, okay. And then you go down South and you're like, I'm a musician. Like, oh, wow, that's amazing. My cousin was the road manager of ZZ Top for 20 years. And my cousin is the guitarist for Bonnie Raitt. That's just how it is. Like, it's such a part. Everybody's
cousin is a musician
of some kind, you know.
And, you know, it's like if you're setting up in a corner in New York, no one's looking at you. No one's curious who you are. No one's curious what you sound like, you know. And even if you are good, it's like, it's so people are just, they just don't have the... They don't have the social skills to go up and tell the person that. We found that in the Southeast, and this was true.
I have, though, been lamenting the switch from honky-tonk to brewery, because honky-tonks were much more fun than breweries, y'all.
Yeah, that's true.
Psht.
But, like,
I hate a brewery over a honky-tonk. Get your craft crap out of here.
Yeah.
I will take Budweiser Miller High Life in a honky-tonk any day over some micro-brew. It's all alcohol. In a brewery where no one's paying attention, rarely is anyone paying attention in breweries. How many times have you gone and seen a band that you like in a brewery and everyone's just talking the whole time? And there's children running around screaming. I don't know if that's a thing up here, but there's like a brewery every other block in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, when we started off, there were more honky-tonk dives than there were breweries. And you made fans and you sold merch. And when you sell merch, I mean, when you sell CDs, that means that people are going to listen to your stuff when you're not there. And that becomes a fan that's like into your stuff. When you're at a brewery, it doesn't matter, it seems. Like, people talk over it. It's that's not the primary function of the space. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So I do miss the dive and the honky tonks that were around 10 years ago that you used to have to call on Fridays between 12 and 4 when the booker was physically there after you had sent a physical press kit to the club a month in advance.
Oh, I don't miss
I don't miss that, but I do miss building those personal relationships with people.
Yeah.
Like, that.
And that was the thing, like, we would go down to the Southeast, and this is kind of what I'm talking about, is we would play open mics, and people would see us, and if they, what we, you know, if you go into a place in a lot of these towns we were finding, and people look at you, and the first thing they know is, well, they're not from here. They want to know who you are. You know, not they just want to know. And unlike the rest of the country, they will actually just go up and introduce themselves and start talking. And it's very, very common. It's very social. Definitely living in the Southeast changed both of us. We talk to everybody now. And we look like people look at us like we're insane, but what else is new?
It's just interesting to me, the cultural differences, like having lived and traveled to many places as an artist where you're not really the help, but you're not a tourist either, you know?
And people want to invite you into their homes more often than you do in any other job. I mean, we've gotten to see this country from people's living rooms in a way that we would never have otherwise. We've gotten to go places that we would never otherwise go and actually get a sense of what the different parts of the country are like and how what people value in different areas, what concerns people have, what everyone's dealing with, you know. It's been really illuminating for us to be able to do this for 10 years. For me, it's an enormous privilege that the circumstances that is my life just was like, here, you do this.
You mentioned booking through MySpace at the beginning.
Yeah, Tom was so much cooler than Zuck, and you can quote me on that. Bring back Tom. We missed you, Tom. Where'd you go, Tom? He's at that desk.
Oh, he's at MySpace. Smiling. That's exactly where he is.
He's at his desk smiling, going, it was good over here. It was. You could search music by genre on MySpace and by town. It was a music site to start with.
Oh, my God.
Justin Timberlake tried to bring it back, like he brought Sexy back in the mid-2000s, but he wasn't able to bring MySpace back the way he brought Sexy back. Sexy was so out of style before that song. You guys are young. You don't remember how out of style Sexy was before Justin Timberlake brought it back.
Yeah, we were all wearing potato bags in the hot summer sun. It was very unsexy. Because
people didn't know how to act.
No, they didn't at all.
Yeah, so he had to bring it back.
He brought it back. But MySpace was a little harder. Sexy, I think, was a little easier sell.
Go ahead. Yeah. Be gone with it.
Yeah.
How, I guess, like, the pros and cons, or I guess, how much harder is it? You said you preferred booking through MySpace.
It sounds like we're old and that we just like everything that was from 10 years ago. But, I mean, the March of the Machines has been real. The democratization of content on and the proliferation of it online had a double-edged sword. There were less people doing this before all of these platforms. The market is very saturated right now. And as you know, I'm sorry, most of it's crap. Most of it's people that have not, I'm not going to say that they're bad at music. I'm saying that they have not worked hard enough on their craft to compete with others that have, that are now competing with spots for other people. So, and there's nothing you can do about that, blah, blah, blah. Like, you're always, as a touring musician, going to have gigs that you play with like a local dude that plays covers, unless you're a big deal, right? Like, but we're not a big deal. So you're always going to have gigs with like yokel dudes that play covers and act like they're friggin' Neil Diamond. And they have no business gigging. They have no business gigging and acting like that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm a jerk, but like, it's the three P's: professional, punctual, pleasant. If you're not two out of those three things, what are you doing? It's not going to work. You know what I mean? And so my whole thing is just when you're a DIY band and there are less rooms than there were to play now. And there are many reasons for this. But there are less rooms to play than there were about 10 years ago. And there's many, many reasons for that. The rise of festivals has drawn a lot of people away. The death of rock music, as we know, and rock is not happening right now. It's just not. There's little pockets of it, but it reflected in the sales, reflected in the ticket sales. You go to, you know, Vice Magazine just wrote something about this. At Governor's Island, you have the Gaslight Anthem with a half-empty field, and you have Post Malone where they have security guards pushing people back. Like, rap is happening right now. That's culturally EDM, that kind of stuff. So, and that's fine. Like, niche presences are just fine. But this has led to the, we don't have a lot of rap and EDM in these 200 capacity to 400 capacity clubs. And that's where regional live and DIY and punk and rock, that's where they live, you know? So with those, a lot of those rooms disappearing, it's because the culture has shifted and what the youths like is very different than it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we were at the very end of post-punk emo kind of stuff. And
10 years ago, we sold CDs.
We sold CDs just hand over fist. It was insane, you know. Now, and it's kind of funny that now you have to sell vinyl.
Oh,
and
we were able, our first tour, we were able to finance it with just CD sales.
Yeah, just CD sales. So it's a very different landscape. And the thing is that I can't say that I prefer what it was like 10 years ago because I have a following now, 10 years later. I'm glad that we stuck our foot in the door when it was hard, when it was easier. I do think it was easier is what I'm saying. There's more bands and less clubs now. And there's more studios. There's just a lot more stuff in the market. But it's like that with every medium, from comic books to science fiction writers to... It's like I said, the democratization of the proliferation of content has just opened this all up to all these people that would have never otherwise published. And there's a lot to wade through to get to the quality. The quality is there. I'm tired of hearing that music isn't as good as it used to be, because it absolutely is. When I say things like rock is dead, I look at someone like Courtney Barnett and go, but like, this is one of the best rock records I've heard in decades. So, you know, it's just one of those things. You just have to wade through more. It doesn't mean that anything is like worse off in general. It just means you really, as a consumer of ideas and content and music and art, you just have to work a little bit harder to find the quality stuff amidst all the rubbish, because there's just a lot of rubbish. And the rubbish is from the DIY level on up to the absolute top of the pops, you know? There is stuff that is rubbish on the top of the pops. That's been going on for a really long time. But there's also stuff on the DIY spectrum, which is just rubbish, you know? And it's I feel like we're going to have a transition period with the arts, where it evens out. Right now, everyone's all in. But now, to be honest, you have to discuss it. The Trump tax plan takes away tax credits for hobbies and hobbyists. So if you're not making, what is it, $28,000 a year from your business or something, you can't claim any of it as a tax write-off. Now, Freakonomics, man, the ripples, the unintended consequences, that's actually going to take a lot of bands from off from touring, because they can no longer, if they're not making that amount of money, they can no longer write off these expenses. And that is going to deter people from saying, oh, I'm a part-time musician. Not if you can't write off gas mileage, you're not. There's going to be people that aren't. So all these things, again, the culture is shifting right now. Culture is always shifting. But these are the things that I see really pushing in the future. I think gas is getting more expensive, first off. You already see, I would say, half the amount of regional touring bands that have a name for themselves regionally, that just stay sort of in one region and aren't nationals. You know, there's just a lot of ways that it's shifting with the increase in fuels. But also, like I said, this tax thing, I'm interested. I don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but think of how many artists and entrepreneurs you know that aren't going to be able to continue their side hustle because they can't write off these expenses on their taxes. It's just an expensive hobby at that point. Mm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So again, I'm not really giving my opinion either way, either as to whether that's a plus or a negative. What if this Trumpian tax cut that I want to scream at ends up making the pool of artists more quality, because you don't have so many hobbyists that aren't devoting their full time to making art? And I'm going to tell you something, there is no substitute for being an artist full time. When your full time job is contemplation and the cultivation of ideas, your work is better than when you have all these other pots burning on your stove. You see what I'm saying?
I just saw something you posted on Twitter about how the difference about being good at the business of music and mm-hmm. being a good artist are completely different things.
And you'll find that the people that are good at the business are going to get farther, always, mm-hmm. in the structures that promote music and make money off of it, or that have a business team. An actual quote that I got, and I'm not afraid to say it, from the Americana Music Association at the Americana Music Conference in Nashville was, quote, you all need, and this is from a radio programmer that works with the Americana Music Association, and I'm not blowing the lid off anything here. They record all these things for posterity. I'm sure they have a record of it somewhere. He said it over a microphone. So he said, this radio programmer said, you all need to learn to make more generic music so we radio programmers can all agree that it's Americana. It's disgusting. They're not artists.
Well, yeah, they're not.
Who are they to say that they get to decide what a genre of music, which Americana means American music. Who are they to decide what American music is and people, what it sounds like?
The people trying to sell that name.
The people trying to sell the trademark.
You see, the thing about music is it's like any creative, and the creative, the arts.
If you guys need to edit that out and change it to something, Shmamericana. I'll give you another sample. Shmamericana. There you go.
But if, you know, the thing about the creative, anything creative, the arts, whatever, going into it from a business point of view, there is no, it doesn't matter how good you are. It doesn't matter how many fans you already have. There's really no guarantee that it's going to be profitable in the way that a business that you're working with would right. need you to be
how
viable.
How do you tell what's going to resonate?
Yeah, you can't. It's impossible. It's literally catching, you know, Gangnam a star style. In the bottom.
Gangnam Style is right. the perfect example. Who could have predicted that a two-year-old single from Korea would be a number top 10 hit, at least.
And the answer is,
I don't know if it was number 1, but it was top 10.
And I don't know how many times, it's literally stars aligning.
We are at a point in music history where best of albums are cracking the top 10.
Yeah.
From like 20, 30 years ago, best of albums. Like, that's crazy to me.
So consequently, people who work in music exclusively on the business end are all, most of them, are gamblers. They like the thrill.
And the musicians, we're all doggies at the track.
Yeah.
That's the thing. They know we're not all going to win. They take us to the track. They run us around the track. And the artists run themselves around the track. Do they not? Chasing that fame carrot. Do they not? And so the business people, they know that they're not going to win every time. But every once in a while, they win big. And they just like hanging out at the track. You know?
Yeah,
that's the music industry in a nutshell.
So if you're an artist, you know, for us as a married couple who writes all our own stuff and does all our own graphic design and does everything that we possibly can that we hold underneath the umbrella that is Megan Jean and the KFB. For us, it's very difficult for us to hand over our content to someone else and say, you go make a lot of money with this, because both we all know that that's still a gamble. But as a married couple with one household and we know what our expenses are, you know, we've been able to survive decently because we haven't gambled our stuff away yet. We've visited the track many times, and we still do pop in and out. But, you know, you got to be cautious, because once you sign away your content, it's difficult for you to make money off of it. You know, right now, we can make money off of our own stuff. But if we gave it to someone else, maybe neither of us would. So you have to be smart, and you have to know your work, and you have to find your audience, and you have to get out there, and you have to just do it. And you can't rely exclusively on social media and everything. I mean, Megan and I just show up and show off, and we're very fortunate that we are able to have something that resonates with people. But even that, we've had to develop. When we started out as a band, I played upright bass and Megan played guitar, and that was it. And, you know, Megan's singing voice is unusually strong, and it just has a way of captivating people. And we were able to rely on that to keep us going at first. But even we realized our own shortcomings as a band trying to tour around the country, in that our music was so soft, there was a lot of venues that we weren't able to get in on. And we were just trying to get up in front of warm bodies and express ourselves. And so, you know, I think we started where Megan started stomping her feet on a plank of wood, where we took a stereo speaker and soldered it to a quarter inch and just plugged it into the PA. It sounds like a dirty bass drum. And she just stomped on that. Actually, our first full-length record, Dead Woman Walking, the kick drum sound is that plank of wood. It was all gotten out of the trash. And so, like, so we did that for a while. And then we just slowly started adding newer instruments. I started playing banjo.
For me, it's been injury. Every single change I've made in the evolution of what I play has been injury. Like, I started off on rhythm guitar, and I like rhythm guitar. I just am not a trained guitarist. Like, I am a trained vocalist, and so the repetition of 200, 225, 240 shows a year at 1 to 3 hours per show, my hands just couldn't take it because my technique wasn't good enough. And I was never in love with the guitar, you know, like it was just something that I did, that I learned, both my parents played, which is actually kind of, you know, that's a little loaded for me because both my parents played, they did not teach me how to play guitar, if you know what I mean. I was like, hey guys, I can do it too. And they're like, yeah, but you're not good enough. So, you know, the honestly, playing guitar was always just a little for me.
Yeah, that's all and, right. I went through my dad's buttons.
Yeah, yeah, my dad's, he's got to catch up to me now, but, you know, he knows it. He has to ask permission to play with me now. Because 8-year-old to 11, 12-year-old couldn't get their time to play that instrument. So now they have to ask my permission to come up on stage with me. And but I will say that watching them play was inspiring to me as a kid, you know. I watched my dad audition for Star Search at the mall, playing a country song on a guitar. He didn't make it, but you know, it was cool. It was cool as a kid to see him like want to make music like that and go and play in bars and stuff like that here and there. You know, for me, guitar was hurting my hands, and then I started playing the stomp box with one of my feet, and I pulled my Achilles tendon, and then I started playing a kick drum while standing up and playing it behind me, and that hurt my hip, because I was leaning out into one hip and locking into the socket, and it stressed the tendons. And then I played snare and washboard. I played washboard for a long time, and the washboard was giving me early onset arthritis from all of the friction in my joints, and the shoulder problems were real from having it around my neck. It was really hurting my neck and all sorts of stuff. So then I switched to snare while standing up, and Byrne played the kick drum seated while he played the banjo. And then I said, I think I can finally sit down and play the drums, because if you're on stage and you get pictures taken from an up angle, it captures all of the many array of chins you could ever possibly have. And I thought that wasn't enough. I thought sitting would also be able to capture the many array of belly shots I could give, because no one ever looks thin sitting down. And so I decided to go ahead and do that thing and give people a nice Lady Buddha and a variety of chins for the pictures, so that my appearance could further be held against me, but in a way that I had chosen. Like when the last booking agent we talked to told me I needed to lose weight, I started lifting weights, and that was a year and a half ago. And now I'm super diesel, so if they tell me that I need to lose weight again, I can pick them up and throw them. I have lost weight, but I've gained a lot of muscle, you know what I mean?
In music, if it's not a hell yes, it's basically...
Yeah, with music, if it's not a hell yes, it's a no. And the thing is that women are always judged by our packaging before our content. That's just how it is. And that's something that I've come to accept, that beauty is the qualifier for women. And there's certain identities to get around that don't have to play. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about for women who are trying to sell creative content, your packaging is always going to be considered by the gatekeepers, always. And it's not the same for men. Men can be affected by their physical appearance, but a man, how many times for a man to be labeled a genius does he have to be good looking? You see what I'm saying? It's very different for a woman to be considered a creative genius. And I find that almost always beauty has to be the qualifier first. That's my personal experience. And I think that beauty privilege is something that really affects women in the music industry in a way that it does not affect men. I'm not saying that beauty privilege doesn't hold for all human beings, because it absolutely does, but I do think that it is absolutely more compounded for women, especially when most of the gatekeepers in this business are still white baby boomer males. That statement might get you banned from Facebook if you play this, but it is true.
You mentioned CD sales and mm-hmm. selling CDs 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Are you still selling CDs? Are you planning on doing anything with vinyl?
We still have CDs. We've partnered with a small vinyl label that we're going to be releasing this next one on, and that's all going, and we're getting it printed up at KinderCore in Athens, Georgia right now as we speak. We have our test pressings in the van. we'll be announcing the label partnership next week. And, you know, like, I'm pretty excited about it. So we have this gorgeous, gorgeous cotton candy color vinyl.
Album record.
We haven't announced it yet, but yeah, it's okay.
This will come out in like,
oh, it's ALO 3 weeks. Records. Yeah. So it's
four records.
Out. Yeah, it's coming weeks. Out on ALO Records out of Macon, Georgia and France. They're sort of like by Georgia, France. And they're friends of ours that have started a label, and they believe in our band. And that's what we've learned at our day at the races in the music industry, is that the people you have on your team have to be as passionate about your work as you are. And that's never quite possible, but sometimes you find these partnerships. And,
because those are the people who are going to be willing to, like, take the leap, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. You know? The people that really believe in your work and resonate with it, yeah. You know.
It's like, if you manage to, like, get a lot of attention and are easy to book around and stuff, you'll have people coming out of the woodwork to represent you. But the second you stop being profitable, they don't care.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, I've had a lot of festy jam band dudes not understand that people don't like to listen to their music. They like the experience of listening to their music in a specific setting that involves lights and smoke and drugs, but they don't take the songs home and listen to them, because who wants to listen to Fritos Out of Control? Like, who wants to listen to that juvenile crap at home? Like, it's frat bro dumb level stuff most of the time. There's a few jam bands that are like, that's a great band, and they have great memorable songs. But for the most part, it's just noodling and like really trite, immature, dumb stuff. Like, there's nothing there. Do you know what I mean? It's like lights on no one's home. It's like one of those Chuck E. Cheese automaton bands. You could switch them out for each other on the stages. The Festy, shows, no one would know.
No, that's true. Festy culture has not been good for band merch.
No.
And that's one thing.
And also, original artists are held to the highest standard. We have to have such big audiences before festivals will take us on. But a jam band can play covers, and they'll get on any number of festivals just right away. They aren't held to the same standard as we are. There's a glass ceiling, though. A jam cover band can only go so far. An original artist, the sky's the limit. It depends on whether your work resonates with people or not. Unfortunately, the biggest mode of discovery now is festivals, and that's a very, very tight elitist group, you know? The gate is very narrow.
It's tough to get into it. And it's like, you know, we've definitely had our audience grow from playing festivals and whatnot. It's just a challenge. Because for us, I mean, because also what we're doing is we're trying to sell our content.
We're trying to sell content. We're trying to sell ideas. But also, we are one of the very few bands that we had zero connections into the music industry at all when we started. Nothing. No cousins in bands. No, my uncle runs this venue. Like, just my friend that I went to high school with is in this band. Like, nothing. We didn't have anything like that. We had to start off from like zero, absolute zero in this. Every time we've had meetings with the music industry, my body is a problem, you know? And that's just what it's been. And the hardest part is that you get gaslit and people go, this thing that you've been told over and over and over again, it didn't really happen. It must be because you're a bitch, you know? It must be because you're mean, or your music's not that good.
Or you're not positive.
Or you're not positive, or this, that, and the other. You hear that a lot, because who's going to say, I don't work with fat chicks? Who's really going to cop to that, honestly? Even if that's 100% the reason, are they really going to say to you? Here's what they say to you. They scan your body up and down, and they go, you need to make this more commercial. Okay? That's what they say. What does that mean? Do I dress up in a McDonald's logo? I thought of putting on a NASCAR suit and just putting logos all over my body. Is this more commercial? Is it? I don't know. When you look at the males on these rosters, and, you know, all love to him. I love a chunky monkey. Chris Stapleton, shout out, my chub boy. Love you. We probably wear the same size pants. Does it matter for that man? No, it doesn't matter for him. I've never seen the equivalent of a female singer-songwriter. I don't think I've ever seen a female singer-songwriter that exists entirely aside from her appearance. I've racked my brain many times to think of a female singer-songwriter that gets to exist as a genius aside from her appearance. it's very hard to think of examples. Everyone says Alabama Shakes. Everybody. There's one. You know, it's frustrating. Because we're people out here, and we're artists out here. And if I was a dude, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah. Wouldn't matter. Also, when you say that to people, you say like, oh, you know, most fans will tell you straight up. They're like, no, we don't care. We just want the
movie. The fans don't care. The fans
don't. I think ultimately the fans don't care. But, you know, but the marketers do care.
The marketers do.
And they care because they don't know what they're selling, and they're going to go for the lowest common denominator that they at least know will work to get people's
attention. Why sell a cheeseburger when you can sell a sexy cheeseburger?
That's right.
Remember Paris Hilton flopping around like a dead fish on the top of a car eating a friggin' Hardee's with mustard all over her face? Like, that's, I mean, like, that, to me, it epitomizes the marketing strategies that I grew up with in the 1980s, which were, of course, the white baby boomer male id. It's the Marilyn Monroe bombshell in the perfect tan Bo Derek, you know, the string bikini, the tan, you know, like, it's just, you're like, you know, I feel like no one else's point of view is ever represented in our media than white baby boomer males. And then there's youth culture, and that's how it's been. But you have to understand that there's been an unbroken streak with the music industry where white baby boomer males have been running everything since for 40 years. So the entirety of the modern music industry has been run by one group of people. And you have to understand that the selection process of what gets promoted is affected by that.
Because no one knows what's going to sell anyway, so the people who are investing their money that they know they aren't going to get back are just going to go with what...
And here's the thing, that's a good point that we've talked about a lot. How can you call for reform in an industry that is a bad investment, that is 100% voluntary buy-in? How can you tell dudes that are spending money that they're most likely not going to get back on music, that they have to invest it in something that they're not attracted to in whatever way that they're attracted to music?
Even if it's base and visceral.
Even if it's base and visceral, like TNA. How can you say you have to reform what bands you invest in on your bad investments that you're probably not going to get a return on anyway? You can't. And that's why I always say this. The music industry is because if you don't fit the mold, you just have to work on building something adjacent. Don't try and change that system because it's a voluntary
system.
Investment on the part of the investors in it, and there are no larger systems governing it. So just build something adjacent. You have to build adjacent power structures if you don't fit the gaze of the industry as it is. And it's been like that for a really long time. I was just talking to a jazz musician, Dana Kurtz, at Folk Alliance International this past year, and we had extensive panels on women in music because of the Me Too movement and all of the ripples that it's had, especially throughout the music industry. If you notice that the Me Too movement didn't really touch the music industry too bad. Why? It's the most sexist arm of the arts besides film, right? Why? And a lot of it is just these NDAs, but it's just there's so few women that none of us want to rock the boat, I guess. I don't have a choice because I don't fit the gaze. So I can be hollering patriarchy and everyone's just like, okay, like we get it, you know, like until we have men getting up on those stages saying this business is sexist, it's not going to do a thing. If the marginalized group could change the direction of the whole thing, we would have by now. It's on the group in power to start dismantling and giving away their power. That's how it works, you know?
As far as the business and being able to sort of dismantle it, do you see streaming as kind of being a golden opportunity to do so? Because examples like Chance the Rapper, who came in and became the best new artist,
Legally,
based off streaming.
Legally it is.
Legally it is. Because I'll tell you this, the laws governing mechanical royalty payouts are
it's like war
radio.
I mean,
they're
really
pre-radio.
Old. And there's,
it's insane. Like they were written before World War One. Like it's absolute insanity. So streaming is actually the only part of the royalty payout system that has any kind of
fairness between the artists and the
because
publishers.
It's been drafted within our lifetimes.
Yeah. So it is. It's an opportunity
because who do you think has more money to lobby Congress to change these laws? Artists
or software companies.
You know, but you know, but you the know? Thing about it is, it's like
Silicon Valley is it's intense to go up, because these services like Spotify, Pandora, Tidal, even their goal, Tidal, I would argue, is different because it's one of the first major black owned entities in the music industry, and it's about damn time. The reason why rap is so good right now is because it's black owned. That is why, you know. And like Tidal is huge for black artists to have that kind of placement in the marketing and in the algorithms. Again, they've always been biased towards white artists and things like that. But the thing is that at this time, these streaming companies, their goal is not to bring music to the masses. Their goal is to make the company public and get a lot of money from the shareholders.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with music. That's just no. What they said. Okay, that's the untapped market.
And the thing is, for streaming to replace like album sales, like it used to be, I don't think that's going to happen. You know, so if you're an artist and you want to make art that people like and find your audience, mm-hmm. and find out how to do it.
You can get by with 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 dedicated close fans.
You really can
if you're okay with being a middle class artist, which I am. Like. That much attention and money and this, that, and the other, that just comes with a lot of pitfalls, a lot of attention, a lot of scrutiny
and
a lot of expenses that I personally would, I'm just not cut out for that. I think I like having a lot of control. I like having a very manageable career, but
I like discovering what I'm good at.
Yeah, I like having enough time to dedicate to other mediums and to just be more of an all-around artist as opposed to just a recording
way we want to push ourselves, not trying to fit somebody else's mold.
Or sell as much as you sold on the last one.
But it's like,
because our story is that we got signed and dropped and signed and dropped in Nashville, and that's why we haven't put out a record for 5 years, and that's essentially the short end of it. We got signed to a big thing, and then we got dropped from a big thing. We got signed to the big thing again, and then we got dropped from the big thing again. In the meantime, we didn't trust them, and we just made our own album. And now we're putting it out. And we were able to raise, just a DIY talk, a big-sized record deal in Nashville these days is worth $50,000. Y'all, it's worth $50,000. Where people used to be getting $100,000, $150,000, $500,000 advances, you're getting $50,000 on a great deal, $10,000 on like an indie deal, right? And anywhere in between. If you're looking at, you're not looking at the majors. You're just looking up to independence, right? Well, we lost the $50,000 deal. We were able to raise $25,000 on our own. Now, I don't owe anyone any money right now. I will only be able to tell in the grand scheme of things whether I am better off from not owing anybody any money on this and just making it off of that, or if I would have done. But right now, it feels really good not to owe $50,000 to a gamble, and mm-hmm. all record releases are a gamble.
As far as plugs go, upcoming album, and then any upcoming shows, and then social media, website, sweet. All that stuff.
So we have a new album called Tarantistas, our first full-length album in 5 years. That we would have put it out years ago, but we were wasting time at the races, and but we got the exact album that we wanted to hear in the world. We're super proud of it. It's a total departure for us. We produced it because we wanted to basically make the ultimate business card for producing an album for ourselves. So we did all the musical arrangements. I did the vocal arrangements. Burn did the musical arrangements for the most part. And we
played most of the instruments on the record. Mm-hmm. And
We did it at the Jam Room in Columbia, South Carolina. And that's our second album that we've done at the Jam Room with a guy named Zach Thomas, who's our production partner, who's incredible.
Yeah.
Amazing ears. It'll be out on vinyl on Allo Records, which is out of Macon and France. Yeah, we're just really excited to get it out. We've already written the next one after that. So we're getting Tarantistas out, and then we're just right back into the studio next year to put out one called Sounds in Siberia in 2020, hopefully. And I don't really care if we get that released on a label either. I'm sort of focused on just putting out as much work as possible at this point.
That's all I care about anymore, to be honest. Yeah. I don't care.
Yeah, so it'll be out on CD, and it will be out on vinyl. We still put stuff out on CDs because, you know, it's just...
Some people
still listen to CDs, and it definitely, the vinyl's gorgeous. It's going to be cotton candy colored vinyl, like white with pink and purple chips swirled into it. And then our
biggest festival coming up in the fall is Muddy Roots down in Cookeville, Tennessee. That'll be Labor Day weekend.
The Meat Puppets!
Yeah, we're going to play the same day as the Meat Puppets. I'm super excited. I've been listening to the Meat Puppets since I was a kid. And we also get to play the same day as X.
Yeah.
I'm like, there's quite a bit. We're going to be there all weekend because it's our wedding anniversary. So y'all should come down to Muddy Roots, Cookeville, Tennessee, because it's got an insane lineup this year, actually. And yeah, we're just going to be playing shows all summer. We're doing a brief little tour out to the Midwest, brief little tour down to the Southeast.
You can follow us at MeganJean.net.
Yeah, MeganJean.net, or search us MeganJean and the KFB on Facebook.
Yeah. All right, awesome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
All right, guys, that does it for this interview. Thanks so much for tuning in. Be sure to tune in again next week. We post every single Wednesday. We are available on iTunes, Podomatic, and Google Play Podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram at The Flat Nickel Podcast. Follow us on Facebook at The Flat Nickel Podcast. Make sure to drop us a like, a favorite, a subscribe, a five-star review wherever you're listening, and we will be sure to get another episode out to you guys next week.